We are now going to discuss a couple of papers on financial instruments, classification and measurement. Julia, are you going to kick off?
Thank you, Hans. Good morning. Just a very brief introduction. In July, the ISB and the FASB concluded joint deliberations of classification and measurement model for financial instruments. The summary of decisions reached to date is provided in Appendix A of Agenda Paper 6A. At this meeting, the staff bring to the board remaining ISB-only transition-related issues. The staff expect that this meeting will conclude the ISB's deliberations of the limited amendments to IFRS 9, except for any SWIP issues. At this meeting, we will ask the board for permission to draft the exposure draft. With that, if there are no questions, I hand over to Rihanna.
Okay, Rihanna, this is your first presentation to the board. We wish you a lot of success.
Yes,
okay. This was not meant to sound threatening.
Are you sure?
Thank you, yes. I'm just keeping an eye on the door there. Agenda Paper 6B considers whether the board wants to provide preparers the opportunity to accelerate the application of the own credit requirements in isolation before the mandatory effective date of IFRS 9. Now, the board published the classification and measurement requirements for financial liabilities in October 2010, which requires that when a financial liability is measured as at fair value through profit and loss under the fair value option, changes in the fair value that are attributable to the changes in the issuer's own credit should be recognized in other comprehensive income. So anyone wishing to use the own credit requirements at the moment needs to apply the classification requirements in IFRS 9 for financial assets as well. However, as a result of the reopening of IFRS 9, entities are unlikely to consider the early application of IFRS 9 before the limited modifications have been finalized. In July this year, the board tentatively decided that in order to improve the comparability, entities will no longer be permitted to early apply earlier versions of IFRS 9 once the limited amendments and impairment projects have been finalized. Entities will therefore have to wait until the mandatory effective date of IFRS 9 before being able to apply the own credit requirements. Now, this will effectively make the application of the own credit requirements dependent on the implementation of an expected loss impairment model with all the associated system changes. So realistically, it would probably be some time before the own credit solutions can be applied. Now, we are continuing to receive requests to accelerate the application of own credit as markets continue to be volatile and the own credit changes remain significant. The FASB considered a similar request in September, but they have rejected the request primarily due to the concerns about including another short-term project in their overall intensive financial instruments project and the low probability that they would be able to reach a decision in time for the year-end reporting. In Agenda Paper 6B, the staff have identified four approaches for the board to consider. Approach A, which is set out in paragraphs 15 to 23, would amend IAS 39 to incorporate the own credit requirements. Approach B would modify the early application guidance in IFRS 9 2010 to permit the early application of only the own credit requirements. And this approach is set out in paragraphs 24 to 31 of the agenda paper. Approach C is similar to approach B in that it would permit only the early application of own credit requirements. But under this approach, the relief will only be provided once IFRS 9 is finalized. This approach is set out in paragraphs 32 to 38. And then approach D, under which no change will be made to IAS 39 or IFRS 9, and own credit will not be able to apply it early. That is set out in paragraphs 39 to 41. Approaches A to C all have a similar outcome, the application of own credit requirements based on the IAS 39 classification and measurement requirements, so an entity could just change its own accounting for own credit and nothing else. The difference between the approaches is in the steps to achieve the outcome and the likely time to completion. I also share the disadvantage of reducing comparability between entities during the period leading up to the mandatory effective date. And they further entrenched the phased application of IFRS 9, something which the board decided against in July. Staff summary is provided in paragraphs 42 to 44, but the staff is not making a recommendation to the board, with some of the staff members favouring approach C, while others prefer approach D, for the reasons set out in the paper. With that, I'll hand over to the board for discussion.
I have to say that I think one of the reasons why we keep on getting this request is that a lot of people are skeptical whether we are ever going to finish this work. And I think in coming up with a solution, we should not feed this skepticism. I am pretty confident, first of all, that we can finish our work quickly, and also that where people expect that endorsement in certain parts of the world might be a problem, I'm not convinced that that will be the case. I'm very confident that endorsement will be coming up. So I think we have to keep this in mind when discussing this issue. Okay. India, I'm not sure.
But, I'm not even talking. The point I want to make is that I came to the room with approach B, but I am willing to go for approach C because there is a crying need, and that need needs to be met in the marketplace. I think taking Chairman Hans's advisory warning before the start of this deliberations, I think we can think about being practical after we go down the path after a few months or see to see whether the approach C is meeting the market needs. If not, we need to be sensible and not be foolhardy to continue with our charging forward and think about approach B at that time. But at this point in time, I completely agree we can go down approach C, but please make it a point that there is a market need. There's a large bank in the United States, in the UK, not too long ago, had the own credit, $6 billion recognized in income statement. I don't know how much of it is fair value through fair value option and how much of it is fair value liability, but I know it's a big number. And so there is a market need. We need to address that. So C meets that requirement, fine. Otherwise, we got to fall back to B down the road.
Darrell?
I would support very much what PK just said. I just want to confirm something that I've... my understanding at the moment is that if we proceed down the process of C, and at a later time the timelines don't work out the way we expect them, at that point we could revert to B without needing to re-expose anything.
Yes.
On that basis, I would reject A because I don't think we should be tinkering with 39. I agree with what PK just said, that we don't want to, we can't leave this issue unresolved. So I would support C based on the current timelines. I think it makes absolute sense. If something changes at a later date, we can always revert.
And if I could just add to that, I think that we wouldn't have to re-expose. So the way that we could do it is if we included in the exposure draft as an amendment to the final IFRS 9, it would be quite simple to
play it on.
To change it to IFRS 9 2010 if we decided that that was more appropriate based on the progress of the phases early next year, for example.
Who would like to say something in favour of another option?
We'll go with ABCD.
Yeah. Something like that. Is there somebody who would like to say something in favour of another option than C?
Yeah. Although C, yes.
Other than C.
Yes.
My belief is that the current reporting of this own credit risk in P&L is very stupid. I've been fighting against it. I remember a long debate at this board table with some people who were full fair value minded, and there was one guy, American guy, sitting over there. But after a long debate, we managed to find a solution, which I think is the right solution. And I would like the solution to be effective as soon as possible. And there is a demand for that. I think my preference, my order of preference for the options to deal with it is exactly the order aligned by the staff, A, B, C, D, A first. I know tinkering with IS 39 may have some difficulties. I'm not aware that this amendment creates any problem in the context of IS 39. It's a theoretical possibility, but I don't see any problem. Maybe you can explain to me. So A would be my first preference. If not possible, for some reasons, I would go to B, which in my view is the quickest way to implement this change in the reporting. Going to C on saying if it doesn't work, we can change back to B, I don't know. I don't think that's the right way, because obviously it doesn't give any certainty to people in terms of timing. So I would go to B first, if A is not possible, and I would not support.
Wouldn't the message be a little bit, Philippe, that as long as you keep resisting long enough, that we will even revert to tinkering with our old standards?
I agree that the perception.
I don't like this at all.
If we go to A, which is amending IS-49, I agree, could give a perception, an impression that we are not sure about our project on IFRS-9. So it's a good argument to go to something which deals with IFRS-9 rather than 39. Then if we go to dealing with IFRS-9, I would use the quickest way to do it, which I think is B, rather than C or D, because it would permit people to change this stupid accounting earlier than under any other possibility.
Can I just explain the timing differences between approach B and C, and maybe that will help to clarify the whole matter. Whether we go for approach B or C, the exposure draft of this change will be included in the overall exposure draft for limited amendments, so we're looking at the same timeline for the exposure draft, the same timeline for the comment period.
That's right.
It's only after that that there's a difference. So whether we amend IFRS 9 2010, that could be published, let's say, by mid-2013, whereas the final standard of IFRS 9 at the moment is expected to be published by the end of the year. So there's only about a six-month benefit at this stage, you know, based on the current assumptions. So the reason it would be quite easy to then, at that stage, decide to rather go for approach B if we see the overall timeline slipping is it's already been exposed in the context of IFRS 9. We can just include it without any further delay if that's how the timeline works out.
I understand that, but I would first go to a solution which would make it, if possible, applicable earlier, and the other option C just uncertain.
My point I wanted to make is we're not really supporting one of the four alternatives, although I do support C, but rather the fact that we're doing classification and measurement changes jointly with the FASB, and we're making some very fundamental changes to IFRS 9 jointly, and yet they are not supporting us in this proposal. We would be, if we issue a joint exposure draft on this matter, we're on our own. Do people see that as a problem? I wonder. I'm not sure.
To be fair, Paul, we didn't have a conversation with the FASB to ask whether they wanted to sort of disconnect the effective dates of their own credit requirements from the entire classification and measurement package. So they had a separate discussion about whether they wanted to do something on own credit completely separate from their project. We haven't asked them the question of whether they would also think it would be a good idea to make people just apply the own credit within the classification and measurement package. They might be receptive to that if they see we do it, but we haven't actually asked them that question.
Okay, I thought the paper says they've already reached that decision.
Their board was asked the question of whether they wanted, separately to the timeline of their classification and measurement project, to do something on own credit, because unlike us, they don't have an own credit requirement that's already in their literature. And so could they do something particularly before the end of this reporting year? And they decided that that was too difficult given all of the other demands on their time. So it's not as bad as that.
I feel guilty to say this, but I have to say, I think we should have discussed this issue in July rather than September. And in July, we denied a phased approach. And then here we come up this issue. And then I think ABC choice is totally against what we decided in July. And if we choose A or B or C, then it will destroy the concept what we have decided. So therefore, provided July's decision is not going to change, then I think only the choice is D. But to be honest, I think we need to discuss whether we should choose only this own credit issue here in September. Is there any chance for us to rediscuss what is the most proper approach, including this own credit risk? So that is my honest opinion. But if there is no choice, then I would choose D.
D.
Can I see who might be in favor of option C?
First choice or second choice?
First choice.
12.
Well, that was a resounding success, Lisa.
Yeah. Thank you.
Rihanna, sorry. Can we move on to, yes? Catherine?
So I'll be presenting the next paper, which is Agenda Paper 6C. And this paper addresses additional transition issues for this project, as well as a knock-on issue for impairment. The first issue in this paper is discussed in paragraphs 6 to 7, and it's whether in the period when the classification and measurement chapters of IFRS 9 are initially applied, disclosure should be required of the line item amounts that would have been reported in accordance with IFRS 9 for the prior periods. Staff recommend that such disclosure should not be required because it would be inconsistent with the comparative relief that was already provided for classification and measurement in IFRS 9. And with that introduction, you can turn to question 1, which is on page 4 of the paper, and open the floor for discussion.
Paul? I agree with Pat Finnegan on this. I'm waiting for him to... he's not here. I'm very reluctant to accept the staff recommendation. I think when you have a traumatic event, like such a large change in accounting policy, the users of financial statements need comparable data for trend analysis. I say the same thing on issue 2, which is not yet up. So, but my general view is it's operationally practical to go back and restate, because we're going to have plenty of lead time on this project for companies to move into it. I think the information is essential for investors.
I think I know what Patricia is going to say.
Really? Ordinarily, I would agree 100%
all right.
with what Paul just said. But the arguments in the paper about the problems with applying hedge accounting in this situation persuaded me that the information might be misleading.
Thank you.
And therefore, I support the staff recommendation.
Well, Paul, you stand corrected.
Well, I'm out on my own on a limb, I guess. But I know Pat Finnegan would be on that limb with me if he were here.
Thank God Finnegan is not here to give a lecture.
Martin, are you also going to surprise me by...
No, absolutely not.
Paul,
I really think in this situation is absolutely not possible, because if you... When the standard is classification and measurement is based on what management's intent is, what is it doing, and it's different, IAS 39 to IFRS 9. Hedge accounting is also really based on, okay, what is really actually be done, and it's based on the standard in which you are in, and therefore I think if you compare that and require people, okay, to report on a standard which you are not really based on your business, your management, in your information which you are given is misleading. And therefore, I really think we should go with the staff recommendation not to require that.
Can I?
You can ask.
Patricia and Martin link the hedging. How about if those companies not use hedging accounting?
I can't imagine.
Still. Whether the basis not required is not so strong enough.
Yeah, but is this really a material question?
No, a minute.
I mean, would you like to make a distinction between?
No, I just want to ask. You know.
Well. Yeah, but if just ask. Okay, just answer.
No.
I think we should remember as well. Question one is really, in my mind, just clarifying the decision that the board already made when it gave the transition relief in IFRS 9. This is really, personally
just,
speaking,
can I see if the board wants to be consistent with its previous decision?
So 2 against
12.
Okay, next question.
Okay, the next issue, which is discussed in paragraphs 8 through 16 of the paper, addresses when the classification measurement chapters of IFRS 9 are initially applied, whether in that period disclosure should be required of the line item amounts that would have been reported in accordance with IS 39 if it had been applied in the current period. To summarize the key points in the paper, this disclosure would require entities to run parallel systems, which is costly, so we should consider the benefits of requiring it. In addition, when the board made the decisions on the effective date of IFRS 9, we also put in transition disclosures in IFRS 7 that were designed specifically to explain the effect of the transition from IS 39 to IFRS 9. And these disclosures focus on the statement of financial position, and when we discussed them with investors, we didn't include line item disclosures for the period, in the current period. And the investors, when we did that outreach, agreed that these disclosures were useful. And lastly, in the staff's view, any line item disclosures for the period would have to reflect all three phases of the project in order to be useful. And as was partially discussed in the last question, the staff don't think that hedge accounting under IS 39 should be applied, especially after IFRS 9 hedge accounting is applied, because hedge accounting is optional to begin with, firstly, and secondly, under IS 39, it can be discontinued at any time. So any disclosure that you would have would be atypical information and confusing or misleading. And so it follows that if this disclosure is not provided for hedge accounting, that the classification measurement disclosure would be incomplete, and the staff recommend that in the period in which IFRS 9 is initially applied, disclosure of the current period's line item amounts that would have been reported in accordance with IS 39 should not be required. And the next question on this topic is question 2, which is on page 7 of the paper. And happy to take questions or open for discussion.
Patricia?
Again, because of the hedging interaction, I support the staff recommendation, provided that none of the disclosures that are listed in Appendix A will be deleted as a result of these decisions.
That's correct. Those disclosures in IFRS 7 would all stay.
Philippe? I'm not fully convinced by the argument of the interaction between hedging and classification. The problem for classifications will be material mostly for banks. Banks, as we know, are not going to adopt the new general hedge accounting model. They will continue to follow the current portfolio hedge accounting until we provide them with a macro hedge
solution. The Macquarie solution will not be available before some time. Martin, if you don't agree about the timing of the Macquarie solution, but if we go to first a discussion paper, exposure draft, etc., it will not be available before some time. So to me, I think that many banks will reclassify and agree that this reclassification might mean they would have applied a different hedge strategy had they reclassified before. So there is some interaction, but not on the accounting standard. It's an interaction between the classification and what would have been their basis for hedging. Is that so severe that it prevents from providing information about just the effect of reclassification, which is how much profit and loss, fair value profit and loss you would have recognized on those assets absent any hedging? I don't think this convinces me that we should provide no disclosure just because they could have hedged those fair value gains or losses that they would report as disclosures.
Martin, you want
to say? It's an invalid assumption that a bank only uses that particular type of hedge accounting that we say, pending the outcome of the macro model, is left behind. They apply several different types, and only one is that one that wouldn't change. The other ones are the ones that would change. So it actually applies, and by bank that can hugely vary. So I think that is just factually not correct. And then the question is, like you say, then there is this interaction. And for a current period disclosure, it is, I think, pure, as the paper says, speculation. And it's bad enough that we have hypothetical derivatives, but to have hypothetical hedge accounting to me is simply outlandish. So I cannot see how you ever get there.
I think the first point, just to make sure we're all clear, is that what we've done as a result of the macro hedge accounting being disconnected from the timing of IFRS 9 is to say that if you're using the interest rate portfolio fair value hedge accounting, you continue to apply IAS 39. Yep. But a lot of the banks use cash flow form of macro hedge accounting, which will be covered by IFRS 9. So they actually will have a lot of their hedge accounting changes.
Will that change the practice of hedging, the accounting practice of hedging? I don't think so.
Yeah, but there's another argument, because
Philippe. Yeah, excuse me. Just what disclosures are we talking about? Just I want to understand. Fair value of the assets at the end of the reporting period. The fair value is objective. It is not affected by whether you hedge or not. It's a fact. The fair value gain or loss that could have been recognized in P&L if you had not reclassified. That's also an objective matter. It could have been offset by some hedging, I agree, granted. And interest income or expense recognized during the period. That is also objective and not affected by hedging.
Those disclosures are in IFRS 7, and we would propose that those particular ones would be required.
That's
fine. Okay, then.
Okay. Clarified, Paul?
Yeah, basically, I share Philippe's view. I can't imagine a company, a bank, or any other company not knowing the impact of a change in the year they make an accounting change. I can't imagine them not explaining that to the board of directors or to their investors. If you say that the information absent, except for the hedging, the hypothetical hedging, which I certainly accept is I don't want to do. If the other information is already required by IFRS 7, then fine. The impact on OCI, the impact on P&L, then fine.
Okay. Who disagrees with the staff recommendation?
Nobody.
Continue, Catherine, please.
Okay. So the next issue in the paper, which is discussed in paragraphs 17 through 33, is a knock-on effect for impairment of the decision that was just made for classification and measurement. In July, the board tentatively decided that in the period when the new impairment model is initially applied, that disclosure would be required of the line item amounts that would have been recorded under IAS 39 for impairment. But a true comparison of impairment would also reflect the classifications under both IAS 39 and IFRS 9, whereas the board just decided that the disclosure of the IAS 39 classifications would not be required in the current period. Therefore, in order to provide a true comparison for impairment, the entity would not only have to track, apply both the incurred loss and expected loss model, but also to track the classifications of assets in that current period under both frameworks, even though they're not required to do so for the classification disclosure. The staff questioned whether the benefit of this exact type of impairment disclosure would exceed the cost of tracking the classifications as well as the impairment applying to impairment models. So in the paper, we considered two alternatives that wouldn't require this tracking and would apply the IS39 impairments to an IFRS9, to assets based on their IFRS9 classifications. The first alternative, alternative one, would rely on the fact that in the new impairment model, interest revenue is calculated on the net carrying amount if there is objective evidence of an incurred loss, as that is defined in IS39. Based on this, at the end of the period when IFRS 9 is initially applied, entities could disclose the carrying amount of the subset of assets where there's the net interest presentation, and also the impairment recognized under both the new model and what would have been recognized under IS 39 on those assets. The main disadvantage of alternative one is that it wouldn't allow comparison between how impairment losses are measured before they become incurred, which is really a key difference between the IS 39 impairment model and the new impairment model. And so on that basis, the staff don't recommend alternative one. The second of alternative in the paper is different because it would apply to all the assets and therefore it would capture the impairment losses that have not yet become incurred. It's broader in scope than alternative one, but it's narrow in scope again than the true comparison because it doesn't consider the assets IS39 classifications. When we evaluated these alternatives, we also considered the existing transition and impairment disclosures, which explain the change both quantitatively and qualitatively, and also give you the ending allowance balances under IS39 for your amortized cost and your AFS assets, and also your beginning allowance balances under IFRS9 for your amortized cost and fair value OCI assets. So because of the interaction with the classification and measurement model and those disclosures, also the limited usefulness of the alternative disclosures that I discussed, and the information that's already available from existing disclosures, the staff recommend that in the period in which IFRS9 is initially applied, that disclosure should not be required at the line item amounts that would have been reported under IS39 impairment. The question for the board is question 3 on page 12 of the paper, and at this point I'll open up for discussion as well.
Stephen?
I agree with your question. I think we should do this.
Question or answer?
I agree with your recommendation. But I think we should do a little bit more, because whilst I agree there's no point having that income statement after and the income statement before, and I agree with all the operational concerns about transition. Obviously, what we have is the transition day, and we have the IS39 balance sheet and an IFRS9 balance sheet. And there's a lot of things going on. There's the reclassifications from one category to another, and then there's the change in the impairment allowance. And I think what we need is a disclosure on that day that really makes transparent all the different things that are happening. And as I said in the small group meeting, I don't think IFRS 7 does it, particularly because of the interaction between the classification and the impairment. So you said that there would be disclosure of the ending IS39 impairment and the beginning IFRS9 impairment, and presumably we would do that by classification, so the amortized cost and the fair value OCI. But the problem is you've got stuff going in and out of amortized cost, so you can't just take the previous ending balance, let's say it's 100, and the new opening balance, say 130, and you can't say, oh, well, impairment has become 30% higher, because you've got no idea to what assets that applies to. So I gave you a suggestion about a table to reconcile the closing with the opening, and did you agree that that table is operational and we should adopt it?
Speaking on behalf of all the banks.
Catherine?
Yes. Can I?
Yeah, but...
It's in this point, exactly, this point.
Okay.
I was in the same small group as Steve, and referring to Sue's comment on the operationality on behalf of the banks. I guess the banks would have all the information Steve's proposed. I think it was very interesting the way he portrayed the change from one regime to the other. I do not foresee any difficulty in operationality for providing that numbers.
Yeah, jokes aside, I think that it would clearly be less operationally burdensome than the sort of period disclosures of the effect over the period, because it's a point in time disclosure, if you like, at the time they're moving from 39 to IFRS 9. So I think that they would view that as a positive. I would imagine they should be able to provide that information based on some preliminary discussions we've had with them, and it's going to be exposed for comment. So I think it's a reasonable proposal, and I think it would help people understand the effect of moving from 39 to 9 at the day it occurs. And I actually think it's more useful to then sort of looking at the ongoing effect of two completely different impairment models, but it makes you understand the starting point.
Daryl?
Would the details of this be something we'd be able to see in drafting and take a view on? Because I'm just a little bit nervous of what is in that reconciliation.
It's very simple.
Useful information.
I would agree with Stephen, because I think what at the transition date you have to really to explain the effects. Is it from reclass? Is it remeasurement? And for both you have to say, is it regarding to which kind of purpose? Is it from impairment, from hedge accounting, or from reclassification and measurement? Yeah. And if you have this kind of table, I think your banks have to be able to explain it, because otherwise how can they do the transition to that? And I think that is useful information. And based on my experience, when I was with Deutsche Bank, we moved from US GAAP to IFRS and IFRS to US GAAP. And this is what you have to have, because you have to explain to the supervisory board, to analysts, and if you don't have by topic and divide it in reclass and remeasurement, I think that is necessary information to make it transparent what you have done.
Who can agree with the staff proposal, including the reconciliation suggestion by Stephen?
13.
Okay, Catherine?
The final issue in this paper relates to the board's tentative decision in July that once IFRS 9 is finalized, that entities should no longer be allowed to early apply previous versions of IFRS 9. Instead, entities could only early apply IFRS 9 as a whole. In order to avoid disadvantaging entities that are preparing to apply IFRS 9 early, staff recommends a lead time of 6 months after IFRS 9 is finalized before entities stop being able to early apply the previous versions. So, for example, if IFRS 9 were finalized on 30 June of 2013, entities could keep early applying previous versions of IFRS 9, but only until the 1st of January 2014, at which time only the final version of IFRS 9 could be applied early.
Who disagrees with the staff? Okay.
Just a point. I agree with the staff's recommendation that we need to give a lead time. But two things we should be conscious and aware of, because somebody, just going by your example of June 30th, if I issue it on July 1, just a day later, then people succeeding year January 1 can still adopt the old IFRS 9. We just have to be careful so that we are not being criticized for that we are playing with the dates by day here and there. Just that's something we need to think about. The other aspect, which is a little bit worrying me a little bit, is that suppose tax country, March 31st is the year end. Okay? So April 1 is the beginning of their year, and you issue the standard on June 30th. Then they have a choice either to early adopt the new standard or go back to April 1 and adopt IFRS 9 retrospectively from the beginning of the year, as if they have adopted. I don't know whether that is something we want to do, people to think about it. I don't come up with any brilliant solution, but my thought is that we need to think about it maybe slightly different and say at the beginning of the next year you cannot use it, or something like that. But this one is bothering me because, if, for example, you issue on June 30th, the next year for them is March 31st, so they cannot use the existing IFRS 9, they have to early adopt. That will be too much work on them. You follow my point?
Well, they could. If they were planning to early adopt as of April 1 and then June 30 we issue the standard, they could still early apply as of April 1.
But the new standard. Or the old standard also they can do it. But they have to go back and restate the previous quarter. I don't know if all regimes allow you to do that. They have to go back and early adopt from the beginning of the year IFRS 9. Although IFRS 9 gave the chance to adopt even in the middle of the year.
It used to. I don't think it does now.
And then you have to go back to the beginning of the year. So otherwise, you are stuck not adopting for a few years.
Doc?
Yeah, just nearly the same point, but I just want to make clear whether there is any other chance for us to discuss this issue for the first-time adopter at the board table, or do we have to discuss it now? If we have another chance, then I can discuss it later, in another day. But if we need to make clear it, I have something to point out.
Probably should raise it now.
Right, okay. I think there is some slight difference between current IFRS users and the first-time adopter, especially for this issue. First-time adopter has to restate, basically, all the previous year from their national GAAP. So therefore, it takes time for them to prepare. And actually, this is actual example. There are many companies who are preparing IFRS based on the current IFRS 9 rather than IS 39. And this is based on the promise which we made before that we are not going to reopen IFRS 9. But now we reopened IFRS 9. And then suppose if the company is planning to start IFRS 1st of July 2014 of July 1st, and with the presumption that we cannot finalize IFRS 9 by the end of 2013, then in that case, if we couldn't finalize IFRS 9, then perhaps this company can use current IFRS 9, right? And then, but fortunately, if we could finalize IFRS 9 by the end of 2013, then lead time is only 6 months. So then they have to apply new IFRS 9. Am I correct? Right. So if I'm correct, then it is quite difficult for them to switch it only within 6 months, because they cannot know whether we can finalize IFRS 9 before the end of 2013 or after the end of 2013. And then if we failed to finalize our IFRS 9, then obviously they need to apply current IFRS 9. And they have to do all the restatement. based on the current IFRS 9. But once we finalize it, by the end of 2013, they need to restate based on new IFRS 9 and finalize it by the end of June. So it, I think in the case of first-time adopter, 6 months is not enough. 6 months lead time is not enough. So that's the point I wanted to raise.
Yes, Julia.
Well, Doug, it seems to me that this question is a slightly broader transition question rather for first-time adopters rather than just specifically about the lead time. And when the board discussed transition in July, we said specifically in the staff paper that we will reassess
the first-time adopters
at a future date. And in your example, there were a lot of ifs. I suppose my suggestion would be to reassess at a future date when some of those ifs are resolved, whether and what needs to be done to accommodate first-time adopters. And we have always stated that we will not disadvantage them.
Then if I have a chance to discuss this issue separately, then I would be happy. But
maybe we need to think about putting a question in the exposure draft that makes sure we get the information that we need to consider the first-time adoption-specific issues in the re-deliberations.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Okay, having heard this discussion, who supports the staff recommendation?
14.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this paper. Okay. We can go ahead with
60. Yes, the next two papers are 60 and 60. Agenda paper 60 discusses the due process steps that the board has followed in considering the limited amendments to IFRS 9. And in January of this year, the fact that the ISB and the FASB decided to jointly re-deliberate certain aspects of their classification measure models to seek to reduce key differences. In staff's view, the board has taken enough due process steps in order to be able to issue an exposure draft. But we would like to note that the FASB's discussions on classification and measurement are still going on. There's no question to the board in this paper, but we're happy to take questions or also for the board to discuss what's been done in the project so far.
Of course, it's not a question. I agree that we have done all what we need to do in terms of due process, and which is the basis for the next question, which is to give you the green light for drafting. But I think it's a bit unfortunate that having decided to make these limited amendments to converge with FASB, we have still at this point in time some uncertainty about the degree of convergence that we will reach. It's a fact. It's something we can regret, but I think it's not a reason for us to delay what we have to do, which is try to complete this IFRS 9 project as soon as possible. So despite this uncertainty on the degree of convergence, I feel comfortable that we should proceed.
Absolutely.
We are planning to give the board a brief update in October about decisions that the FASB have made so that you're aware of any differences between the two sets of decisions.
Stephen.
Well, as you know, I'm going to vote against this ED and write an alternative view. Just on paragraph 14 of this paper, and the reason for my objection, of course, is fair value OCI. And I, you know, Philip was mentioning about differences with the FASB. It does strike me that one of the reasons we went into this was to reduce differences, and yet a whole lot of other differences have opened up, impairment and equity securities are the two. And also in B, this articulation of the business model, you say about application guidance, but we haven't seen that yet. And I'm not entirely convinced that we will have a clear classification and basis for the classification. And I'm not sure that it is going to be principles-based or effectively a bit of a free choice over some of these categories. So I'm anticipating comments I'm going to make to the next paper, but I do have concerns with this paragraph 14 in here.
Amaru?
It's just a clarification. In paragraph 26, you mentioned that we perform more extensive outreach. So what do have the staff have in mind of this outreach for this?
Well,
because of the word more extensive, so what's the difference if extensive and more extensive?
I think what we tried to articulate in this paragraph was that obviously when we developed the papers for the board consideration, we did perform some limited outreach and we did speak to some constituents. However, it wasn't a comprehensive outreach program. When the board issues the exposure draft, we will perform an extensive outreach program to solicit views of the constituents and to feed those views back to the board for their re-deliberations.
So we'll target investors, for example, to supplement the comment process, and also we'll do something like we did on IFRS 9 originally, not as extensive, I don't think, but that sort of thing of public discussions, etc.
We're ready to go to the final question.
Okay. So the questions for the boards are in Agenda Paper 6E. The first question is whether the ISB grants the staff permission to begin the balloting process for an exposure draft proposing limited amendments to IFRS 9.
Yes. Who disagrees with the staff's recommendation? Nobody?
And the next question is whether any board members intend to dissent to the proposal.
I think I just heard one.
Yep.
Voila.
I will consider on the same basis as Steve. I've learned that in the insurance, which was part of this, there is quite a lot of insurance companies that are quite unhappy with what we are doing. And I've also understood that there are quite a lot of complexity that we add with this solution. So I will consider dissenting.
But Jan, are you saying that insurance companies are unhappy with classification and measurement, or the interaction between classification and measurement and the insurance contracts project?
Well, I think that quite a few that I've met or heard about are unhappy that they are being forced to give up what they consider to be a good model today, where they can bring current measurements into profit, and that they don't like that. And that was one of the reasons for why we added back this complexity to IFRS 9.
I'm concerned about a third major change to IFRS 9, besides the two that were identified in paper 6D, and the third one is recycling. I am also concerned that we will end up with four categories of financial assets, having just a couple of years ago publicly said every way possible that our goal in IFRS 9 is to reduce the number of categories from IAS 39, but we now have fair value through OCI, no recycling for equity, fair value OCI with recycling for debt. We've got two categories of assets, and I worry that the distinction between the two other categories, and I worry the distinction between them is quite optional, and I worry that we're reintroducing intent-driven accounting. Held to collect is an issue of intent, and I forget the words we're using for fair value through OCI for debt, but it's also quite intent-driven. I haven't made, like Jan, I haven't made up my mind yet for sure, but I worry whether this is a step in the right direction or not.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's...
One final question.
Oh. Okay.
Sorry, Hans, which is the comment period for the EV.
Yeah.
The staff recommends that we have the normal 120-day period that's set out in the due process handbook.
No, I won't.
Does everyone agree, or?
PK wants to ask a question.
I agree with 120 days, but I'm slightly confused, and I apologize for this confusion, and it's my mistake. When in July we said we are going to have all IFRS 9 in one package, once we issue it, why are we doing it in breaking into different exposure traps? Is there any logic to that? Is there a timing to that? Because the classification measurement is one exposure trap, potentially impairment is another exposure trap. I'm just thinking that, with the timing and all that, this is related to 120 days in that sense, because I want to see both together, maybe. I'm not opposing, I'm just curious, what is the staff's logic on this?
We have thought about this and discussed it quite a bit. Think of nothing else, PK. And I agree with you that if the timing of the impairment and classification measurement EDs is close, I think we'll recommend the same comment period for the impairment document. So it would be 120 days as well. And I think it would be easier for our constituents to look at one document, particularly given the interaction between the fair value through OCI category, which we've said in P&L should look like amortized cost, and the classification and measurement proposal. So in an ideal world, I think we will package it as one, but then do the invitation to comment in a way where you can decide whether you want to answer all the questions or some, depending on which parts of the project you're interested in, so you can see it as a suite. But we're leaving it open and sort of asking you the questions separately at the moment, just in case the timing doesn't line up.
So in your best estimate,
does it line up, do you still potentially go forward the CNM?
I think I'd rather put out classification and measurement and have that process running if there's still questions around the impairment timing, and if we decide that we need to tidy up, for example, the transfer criteria, et cetera, and impairment. If that's going to take some time, then I think that we should probably go forward with the classification and measurement to get as much stability as we can.
What's the best
thing is be aware that there could be a potential for people asking more time on the C&M response with the impairment if they get off.
And I'm sure there'll be some who'll say we want to see insurance as well. So
that is pushing it.
Well. The best estimate of publication of the ED on classification and measurement was for guests today.
Hoping November.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we thank the staff and wish them success in
that.
We reconvene at 11:20.
Thank you.